God did want. So what imparts us life? Faith in Him. Our faith in Him is what gives us righteousness. Active faith, granted, but it's our faith in Him. If you don't have a faith, and that's the whole point Paul goes over and over in most of his books, is the difference between faith and law, faith and law. Law, if you could keep all those things of the law, then you could earn what your salvation is. You can't. You have to have faith. Moving on. But before faith came, we were kept in custody under the law, being shut up to the faith which was later to be revealed. Therefore the law has become our tutor to lead us to Christ, so that we may be justified by faith. But now that faith has come. We are no longer under a tutor. For you all are sons of God through the faith in Jesus Christ. For all of you who were baptized into Christ have clothed yourself with Christ. There is neither Jew nor Greek. There is neither slave nor free man. There is neither male nor female. You are all one in Jesus Christ. And if you belong to Christ, then you are Abraham's descendants, heirs according to the promise. And the promise was to Abraham. What was that? Anybody remember? What was the big promise? The one that probably concerns us most, because there's three. What was the big promise to Abraham? You got to speak louder than that. Abraham's going to be blessed. Everybody after Abraham's going to be blessed through his seed. All mankind will be blessed through his seed. Who or what is Paul referring to here as faith? Is it a who or is it a what? That'd be Jesus, okay? He's referring to Christ in this particular, most of this context here, as faith, when faith came. Because who was the first person that showed faith in God? Abraham. You can say that louder. Okay, so when you're talking about a what, you have to look at the context of Paul. Here he says, when faith came. Well, certainly he had faith with Abraham back when Abraham was here. So what he's talking about is Christ. So what role did the law play with Christ? I'm going to repeat what you said because the microphone may not pick it up. It was to set up things for Christ. It was the structure so he could understand the path to Christ is what he said. Anybody else want to add to that? That's true. Christ fulfilled, what is it, every jot and tittle? In other words, every fine point of the law, he satisfied. And when he satisfied, what happened to the law? It's done. It was done. Okay, the term that they use here in the, let's see, that's verse 24, is tutor. And pedagogos is the word in Greek for what it is. What it referred to was a servant that was supposed to be instructing the child of the master to do things. And part of that responsibility for that servant was to do whatever kind of discipline he had to do to get that child instructed the way they needed to. So the child could be suffering corporal punishment or whatever it is at the hands of the servant under the master's direction. So the servant there was the one who was helping the person as a tutor come along. It wasn't just strictly instruction. It was tough instruction to bring someone to where you want them to be. And that's the Greek word that's used here as far as how it is. And how does that relate to us? How would you relate to us in the way that tutor is described. Is it warm in here? No? Okay. Christ wasn't the tutor. Who's the master? God. Who's the child? We are. Who was the tutor? The law. Okay? So that's the relationship that he's drawing there, is to us today, that's the relationship that they had coming up through the law, was the law was a tutor to get his children to the point where they were ready for Christ. Going back into Numbers. And the reason I did this is because I wanted to look at some of the Old Testament and then look at some of the New Testament and compare them and pull some of those things out that were in the Old Testament from the Mosaic period that really relate to what we're talking about in the New Testament. So, Numbers. Now, these are the records of the generations of Aaron and Moses at the time when the Lord spoke to Moses on Mount Sinai. These, then, are the names of the son of Aaron: Nadab, the firstborn, Abihu, Eleazar, and Ithamar. These are the names of the son of Aaron, the anointed piece, whom the ordained to serve as priests. And then on in Numbers 18. So the Lord said to Aaron, "You and your sons and your father's household with you shall bear the guilt in connection with the sanctuary, and you and your sons with you shall bear the guilt in connection with your priesthood. But bring with you also your brothers, the tribe of Levi, the tribe of your father, that they may be joined with you and serve with you, while you and your sons with you are before the tent of the testimony." What's this talking about? What's this setting up? Huh? The tribe of Levi, but what's it setting up? The priesthood. Okay? So who was the first priest ordained under the law? Aaron. Some of these are easy. What's the constraints on who could be a priest? Tribe of Levi. What did the priests do? Well, they carried the ark, and they didn't get killed when they carried the ark. They tended the sanctuary. What's the biggest thing they did? Sacrifice. For the people and themselves, which is kind of important. So in Hebrews, now the main point in what has been said is this: we have such a high priest who has taken his seat at the right hand of the throne of the majesty in the heavens, a minister in the sanctuary, in the true tabernacle, which the Lord pitched, not man. For every high priest is appointed to offer both gifts and sacrifice. So it is necessary that a high priest also have something to offer. Now, if he were on earth, he would not be a priest at all, since there are those who offer gifts according to the law. So the Hebrew writer is talking a contrast here. And it kind of pivots on what we just looked at in Numbers. What did Christ, though, and a Levite priest have in common? Huh? They're both priests? Okay. They both offered sacrifices, didn't they? What was the sacrifice for what the Levite gave? Goats, bulls, birds, lambs. It had to be unblemished. Supposedly unblemished. I'm not really sure what they sold in and around the temple. I have a feeling they may have had some good-looking lambs and good-looking calves and stuff like that, but that was the ones they had ordained so they could make money. But that sacrifice was to help them understand the separation because of sin, wasn't it? What has always been the thing that has redeemed man? Well, that sacrifice had to happen to justify man being saved. But what is it that man has always had that justified grace being given to him? What do they offer these sacrifices up in? Faith? Is that what you said? They offered it up in faith, didn't they? It says the blood of bulls and goats and everything like that can't take away sins. So what is it that redeemed them from their sins? Their faith. Huh? Faith that it would work. Faith that God would do what he would do that was going to be good. It's like Abraham when he took off and he said, just go. Just go, Abraham, and I'll tell you when you get there. He said, whatever it is God's going to do, it's going to be good. Yep. That's right. And that faith is what saved him. What was the sacrifice that Christ made for? For what? It was to reunite us with God. That's what his sacrifice was for. Different than what the other high priest was for. A different purpose. Both giving up sacrifices, blood sacrifice. Why the difference? Huh? He was perfect. The Levite priest had to give up a sacrifice for himself and his family. Christ didn't have to give one up, but he had to give himself as a sacrifice, because what happened to him just before he died? I can't hear you. He took all our sins. He took the whole sins of everybody for all time. Ever lived, ever will live, we're living then, on himself. But that was the paradox. He hadn't been responsible for any of them. That's why Satan couldn't hold him. He said, I got sin, but none of it's mine. So he couldn't hold him. So the Father raised him on the third day. Whoa, that's kind of interesting. Now, Exodus. You shall make a veil of blue and purple and scarlet material and fine twisted linen. It should be made with cherubim, the work of a skillful workman. You shall hang it on four pillars of acacia wood overlaid with gold, the hooks also being of gold, on four sockets of silver. You shall hang up the veil under the clasp and shall bring in the ark of the testimony there within the veil. And the veil shall serve for you as a partition between the holy place and the holy of holies. You shall put the mercy seat on the ark of the testimony in the holy of holies. You shall set the table outside the veil and the lampstand opposite the table on the side of the tabernacle toward the south, and you shall put the table on the north side. You shall make a screen for the doorway of the tent of blue and purple and scarlet material and fine twisted linen, the work of a weaver. You shall make five pillars of acacia for the screen and overlay them with gold, their hooks also being of gold, and you shall cast five sockets of bronze for them. A lot of gold, a lot of silver, and copper and tin, which is bronze. What's being described here? Specifically. Well, it's a part of the tabernacle. The difference between the Holy of the Holies and the holy place, right? Okay. It's specifically the veil that exists between the two of them. It's a pretty substantial veil that separates the two. Why is there a separation? Sorry, can't. God said, God came into part of that. Which part? Holy of Holies. How many times a year? Once. Whoa, that's even worse. Is there a door open up there, Don? Don. Don Page. Is there a door open up there? That's a yes. It's trying to suck my screen into the baptistry. Okay. So who could go into the Holy of Holies? The high priest. Period. Okay? Only the Levite chief priest. He's the only one who could go in the Holy of Holies. You You can stand there and hold that. Ah. What did the priest do when he was in the Holy of Holies? Can't hear you. Offered sacrifice, okay? That's where he offered his sacrifice. There with God. Go into Hebrews. Who serve a copy and a shadow of the heavenly things, just as Moses was warned by God when he was about to erect the tabernacle. For see, he says, that you make the things according to the pattern which was shown you by the mountain. And now he has obtained a more excellent ministry, by which, as much as he is the mediator of a better covenant, which has enacted better promises. So the contrasting the two priests here. What was the shadow of heavenly things? The tabernacle, right? Particularly the Holy Holies. Other than that, it was just a tent, right? Of course, when he went into Solomon and everything like that, it became a structure as opposed to a tent. But once a year, the Holy of Holies was a shadow of heaven. Oops. What was it specifically a shadow of? The throne. The mercy seat was a shadow of the throne. So who initially ministered to God on our behalf? Our being his people. Huh? The priests. Okay? The Levite priests. Who now ministered to God on our behalf? Christ. You can kind of see the parallels between the Old Testament and the New Testament. So moving on, back into Exodus. It's kind of changing the subject a little bit. Instead of talking about the priests, I'm going to talk about something else. For the Lord will pass through to smite the Egyptians. And when he sees the blood on the lintel and on the two doorposts, the Lord will pass over the door and will not allow the destroyer to come into your houses to smite you. And you shall observe this event as an ordinance for you and your children forever. When you enter the land which the Lord will give you, as he has promised, you shall observe this rite. And when your children say to you, what does this rite mean to you? You shall say, it is a Passover sacrifice to the Lord who passed over the houses of the sons of Israel in Egypt when he smote the Egyptians, but spared our homes. And the people bowed low and worshiped. Then the sons of Israel went and did so, just as the Lord had commanded to Moses and Aaron, as so they did. Now it came about in the midnight that the Lord struck all the firstborn of the land of Egypt, from the firstborn of Pharaoh, who sat on his throne, to the firstborn of the captive who was brought, who's in the dungeon, to all the firstborn of the cattle. Everybody knows what this is, Passover. Where did the blood come from that went on the doorposts and the lintel? The lamb, the sacrificial lamb. Okay, an unblemished lamb. What was its purpose? To identify the people that were to be saved, not put to death. It was a sacrifice for God to spare them. Wasn't it? So, look at Corinthians. Your boasting is not good. Do you know not the little leaven leavens the whole lump of dough? Clean out the old leaven so that you may put in a new lump, just as you are in fact unleavened. For Christ, our Passover, also has been sacrificed. Therefore, let us celebrate the feast, not with old leaven, not with the leaven of malice and wickedness, but with the unleavened bread of sincerity and truth. So here's a reference to Christ as the Passover. And they know what he's talking about when Paul's talking to the people in Corinth. At least some of them do. Corinthians mostly are Jews or Gentiles? Gentiles. In Corinth? Greek? Big Greek city? So what event does Paul draw a parallel to with respect to Christ? The Passover, the original Passover. Okay? He says, Christ is our Passover. He's that sacrifice that saves us from death, as opposed to the children of Israel that were stuck in Egypt at this time. So what parallels are there in remembrance of Christ in the Passover? It's up there on the table. That isn't up there on the table right now. The Lord's Supper, okay? They had a remembrance every year, and it's long, but they had a memorial every year for the Passover. They had bitter herbs and spices to say how bad our bondage was down there in Egypt, all right? They had the lamb that they ate that was a remembrance of the sacrifices that God made to get them out of there. They had unleavened bread because they were supposed to say, you're supposed to be ready to go. You don't have time to make leavened bread and let it rise. In the Passover feast, in our feast, we have unleavened bread to remember his body. We have the fruit of the vine to remember his blood. Strong parallels between the Passover feast and the feast of our communion. Leviticus. Then Aaron shall offer the bull of the sacrifice offering, which is for himself, and make an atonement for himself and for his household. And he shall slaughter the bull of the sin of offering, which is for himself. He shall take a fire pan full of coals of fire from upon the altar before the Lord, and the two handfuls of finely ground sweet incense, and bring it inside the veil. So this is getting ready for him to go on the other side of the veil once a year. So why did Aaron have to make a sacrifice? And all the Levites. He needed to be purified before he went in there because of the sins of himself and his household. Going on to Hebrews then. Therefore, since we have a great high priest who has passed through the heavens, Jesus, the Son of God, let us hold fast our confession. For we do not have a high priest who cannot sympathize with our weaknesses, but one who has been tempted in all things as we are, yet without sin. Therefore, let us draw near with confidence to the throne of grace so that we may receive mercy and find grace to help in time of need. Differences between high priests. Here in the Hebrews writer is talking about a different high priest, right? Who's he talking about? This is easy. Christ. Okay. What sacrifice did Christ offer? Himself. Why did he have to offer a sacrifice? The high priest had to offer a sacrifice because he had sin. Why did Christ have to offer his sacrifice? Because we sin, okay? Because of the sins that we did that he took on himself. What's the difference between the two sacrifices? Theirs is every year, ours is one time and done. One big difference that it talks about in here is, could they grow close to God with confidence because of the Levite priest? No, they couldn't. But Christ's sacrifice should make us bold to go to God because we're supposed to be there because he died so we could be there. That confidence you didn't have in the Old Testament. Paul talks about that in several books, but he talks about it first in Galatians in the fact that we should now have confidence to go in front of God, which is interesting because is the throne of God a quiet place or kind of scary? Kind of scary, okay? But we should have confidence to go in his presence because of Christ. Big difference when under the Levites, only one person could go in there. He could go once a year. And there were certain conditions under which he could go in there. And if he didn't go underneath those conditions, he was dead. Let's look at it in Leviticus and what he had to do. He shall put the incense on the fire before the Lord. The cloud of incense may cover the mercy seat that is on the ark of the testimony. Otherwise, he will die. Moreover, he will take some of the blood of the bull and sprinkle it with his finger on the mercy seat on the east side. Also in the front of the mercy seat, he shall sprinkle some of the blood with his finger 7 times. Then he shall slaughter the goat of the sin offering, which is for the people, and bring the blood inside the veil, and do with its blood as he did with the blood of the bull, and sprinkle it on the mercy seat and in front of the mercy seat. He shall make atonement for the holy place because of the impurities of the sons of Israel and because of their transgressions in regard to all their sins. And thus he shall do for the tent of the meeting which abides with them in the midst of their impurities. When he goes in to make atonement in the holy place, no one shall enter the tent of the meeting until he comes out, that he may also make atonement for himself and for his household and for all the assembly of God. Just a note, why did he do it 7 times? Do you remember that from Mike's lesson as far as the number 7? What? Complete, okay? I completely offered a sacrifice for the sins, because 7 means completeness. So why did the priest have to cover the mercy seat with smoke? So he couldn't see God. Remember when the time that God went by Moses, he put his hand there, he says, no one can see me and live. So he had to cover the mercy seat with smoke because God came there. And if he saw him, he was dead. And what enabled the priest to enter the Holy of Holies to commune there with God? The blood, the sacrifice, a blood sacrifice. That enabled him, as a child of God, to enter in the Holy of Holies and commune with God once a year. But he couldn't see him. Who else was allowed to go in? Everybody shaking their head. Nobody. Nobody at all. Everybody had to leave the area. So, in Matthew, this one's going to take about 3 slides to get to my point. Now, from the 6th hour, darkness fell upon the land until the 9th hour. About the 9th hour, Jesus cried out with a loud voice, saying, Eli, Eli, lama sabachthani. That is, my God, why hast thou forsaken me? And some of those who were standing there, when they heard it, began saying, this man is calling for Elijah. Immediately one of them ran and took a sponge and filled it with sour wine, put it on a reed and gave him a drink. But the rest of them said, let us see whether Elijah will come to save him. And Jesus cried out again with a loud voice and yielded up his spirit. And behold, the veil of the temple was torn in two from the top to the bottom, and the earth shook and the rocks were split. The tombs were opened, and many bodies of the saints who had fallen asleep were raised. And coming out of the tombs after his resurrection, they entered the holy city and appeared to many. Now the centurion and those who were there keeping guard over Jesus, when they saw the earthquake and the things that were happening, they became very frightened and said, truly, this was the Son of God. What's this scene? The death of Christ, okay? What symbolic event occurs during his death? The ripping of the veil from the top to the bottom. Not from the bottom to the top, which is normally, you know, because all the top is reinforced. It's got clasps, it's got all kinds of things. It was ripped from the top to the bottom. It denoted that the throne was now open to everybody because of the sacrifice. It was no longer a barrier. It let everybody into the Holy of Holies. Before, it was one guy once a year. Now it's all of us, all the time. So there's a parallel, but boy, they sure built upon that. He sure built upon that parallel to say it was once a year. Now it's all the time, everyone. You all have access to God because of his sacrifice. How is Christ able to enter the Holy of Holies? He's the high priest. He's the high priest and the sacrifice, the perfect one, the only perfect sacrifice that's ever been sacrificed to him. Therefore, brethren, since we have confidence to enter the holy place by the blood of Jesus, by a new and living way which he inaugurated for us through the veil, that is, his flesh. And since we have a great priest over the house of God, let us draw near with a sincere heart, in full assurance and faith, having our hearts sprinkled with clean from an evil conscience, and our body washed with pure water. So how do we enter through the veil? Who's the veil? What does it say? Enter through the veil, his flesh. Through him. Remember, he calls himself the gate or the doorway. Here he's referring to himself as the veil. Through him, we have access to the Holy of Holies. Because he offered for our sins, what does that make Christ? Easy. This is easy. Makes him the high priest. Our high priest. The highest priest, if you will. It's kind of interesting contrast. I wonder if I get into this. What else does his blood do for us? Identifies us. Okay. Says we're part of his. Also his spirit. His spirit is the kind of the stamp, if you will, that says, you're mine. And what justifies the spirit being in it is his blood. But it also sprinkles our heart clean from an evil conscience. Again, Paul keeps making that point over and over again. Back in Exodus. Now Mount Sinai was all in smoke because the Lord descended upon it in a fire. And its smoke ascended like the smoke of a furnace, and the whole mountain quaked violently. When the sound of the trumpet grew louder and louder, Moses spoke, and the God answered him with thunder. The Lord came down on Mount Sinai, on top of the mountain, and the Lord saw Moses, called Moses to the top of the mountain, and Moses went up. Then the Lord spoke to Moses, go down, warn the people so they do not break through the Lord to gaze, and many of them perish. Let also the priests who come near to the Lord consecrate themselves, or else the Lord will break out against them. Moses said to the Lord, the people cannot come up to Mount Sinai, for you warned us, saying, set bounds about the mountain and consecrate it. Whereabout is this in the delivery of the Israelites from Egypt? Before they crossed the Red Sea. It's really early. Okay, it's Mount Sinai. So what made Mount Sinai so scary? God dwelling there, and it was smoking, it was lightning, it was trumpets, and those trumpets probably weren't very, they were loud. They were really, really loud, okay? But it showed his incompatibility with man because of man's sin, didn't it? All those thunderings and lightnings, I mean, it showed the power of God, but it also, what did it tend to do with people? It made them stay away. It kind of protected them, because if it looked like it was a nice place, people may go up there and see God, and what happens when they saw God? They're dead. Okay, so part of it was for their own protection. So go back to Hebrews. For you have not come to a mountain that can be touched, and to a blazing fire, into darkness and gloom and a whirlwind, into the blast of a trumpet and the sound of words, which sound such that those who heard it begged that no further a word be spoken to them. For they could not bear the command, if even a beast touches the mountain, it will be stoned. And so terrible was the sight that Moses said, I am full of fear and trembling. But you have come to Mount Zion, and to the city of the living God, the heavenly Jerusalem, and to myriads of angels, to the general assembly, and the church of the firstborn who are enrolled in heaven, and to God, the judge of all, and to the spirits of the righteous made perfect, and to Jesus, the mediator of a new covenant, and to the sprinkled blood which speaks better than the blood of Abel. So finally in Hebrews, I'm going to do real well today, time-wise. Where is Mount Zion? Anyone remember? What? It's what? In the desert. Okay. Physically, it's really right there in Jerusalem, near the city of David. It's right there in that general area. It's where they moved in and around where they moved the tabernacle to, because it was a mount. Okay. Kind of a hill, more than a mount, but it was Mount Zion. Okay, so it's considered that. But what Mount Zion is being referred to here? Heaven. Okay. The tabernacle, which was the shadow of heaven, was at Mount Zion in Jerusalem in the Old Testament. The new Mount Zion is where our new high priest is at the real throne of God that he's talking about here. So he makes a direct parallel between that mountain, which was very approachable. I mean, it wasn't scary. Mount Zion wasn't scary. It was where the tabernacle was. It was where the Jews were. It was right there in Jerusalem. What makes Mount Zion not scary as opposed to Mount Sinai? Mount Sinai was the thundering, the lightning, everything else. Mount Zion is not scary. God's in both places, right? What's the difference? We can approach God because of Christ in Mount Zion. We didn't have a sacrifice that allowed us to approach God in Mount Sinai. That's the difference. He enabled us to go in with boldness to God in God's presence. Whereas back in Sinai, we couldn't do that. Okay. So just a couple ways from what we talked about. Where is Christ foreshadowed in the law of Moses based on what we talked about this morning? How about these? Blood sacrifice to enter the presence of God. Old Testament, Christ was the blood sacrifice. The only one authorized to offer the sacrifice was the high priest. Old Testament, Christ. Passover, direct parallel to Christ. In the remembrance and the sacrifice. Tabernacle, shadow of heaven. Direct parallel. And Mount Zion, we're welcome there because of Christ. Because of the sacrifices, because of who they were welcomed at Mount Zion when it was physically here. Because Christ is there and the sacrifice is offered, we're now welcomed at Mount Zion, the heavenly one. Questions? Comments? Does that make sense? Does that make some sense? Didn't put you to sleep? Next week, the coming of Christ, part one. Either Doug or I will be teaching it. We haven't worked that out yet. So it'll be one of the two of us. Thank you for your attention.